Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, I have the pleasure of having international jazz legend Joe Sample. We're going to talk about his career and his music and his wife. If you want to tune into the show, give him a call. You can call in at 347-324-3460. Again, that number is 347-324-3460. Or you can post a question in the chat room, and I can read it on the air. Well, Joe Sample, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Okay. I guess to begin with, like I was just telling you just before we got started, a lot of our audience like to hear a personal view, where the person is from and how they came to be. So if you can have a moment, if you don't mind, tell us about yourself.
Well, I grew up in southeast Texas, Houston, Texas. My family migrated from Louisiana into southeast Texas, I would say somewhere in the early 1920s. In 1927 is known as the Great Flood of 1927, where the Mississippi River was dynamited, and that was to save the city of New Orleans from being hit by a tsunami that was coming down the Mississippi. They dynamited the river, and 800,000 people in western Louisiana had to leave. So I grew up in a community of Louisiana people who are the terribly moved over to Houston, or they were forced out because of the Great Flood of 1927. That was a community known as Frenchtown. In Frenchtown, half of the older people could not speak English. It was the patois from Louisiana. Everyone was speaking. So I went to kids. I went to the Catholic school with the kids who had struggled with the English language, and that was because they, they spoke French, and they were having major problems. And at the same time, if you had that heavy Louisiana brogue, the Texans considered those people as stupid, or pretty dumb. You know what? That this phone just beeps. I may get cut off from you.
Okay. What we can do is we can play one of your songs real quick that your agent sent me, and I guess give you a chance to trade phones.
Hang on for 1 second. Let me go and
okay.
And take care of this phone business.
No problem.
Yolanda?
While he does that for a second, everyone, why don't we take a break real quick and listen to Soul Shadow by Joe Sample, and we'll be back in a moment. Again, that was Joe Sample with Soul Shadows. Well, Joe, welcome back to the program.
All right, thank you.
Okay. I guess we left off with Frenchtown.
Yes, and so it was in the Fifth Ward of the city. We were segregated. My experiences for 19 years in my life was that I had never really been around any other race of people, you know, Asian, Mexican, white, and that was Texas law. It bothered me, of course. I sat on the back of the bus. I drank out of the colored fountain. I was there in the beginning of the, or let me say, it was my generation who became very, very forceful in saying that the laws had to change. And although in 58, I left Houston, I had completed all of my music studies at Texas Southern University. I was a freshman there. When I was 16 years old, I ran throughout all of the music courses, and I only had one thing on my mind. I had to get somewhere where the big boys were playing music. There was either New York City or Los Angeles. I had relatives in California and Los Angeles, and that's where I chose to go. Also, my buddies and other musical friends, the Crusaders, we all left here in a caravan and went out to Los Angeles June of 1958. And that year, I was 19 years old. And somehow we survived.
Wow. Powerful story. Really appreciate it. Coming from the culture, you know, it's kind of strange. You only have certain communities that, ironically, Wikipedia, which is an online dictionary, actually writes about. And it's so unusual regarding Houston history and Fifth Ward that even Wikipedia has a whole column about Fifth Ward. But out of that, you know, from the roots of Louisiana, this particular community have some legends, I mean, like yourself. I mean, you have George Foreman, you have Barbara Jordan, you have Mickey Leland, you have the Ghetto Boys, you have Illinois and Russell Chiquet, you have Milton Larkin, Arnett Cobb, the president of Brown University, can't think of her name, Ruth Simmons, and just to name a few, a lot of basketball players. What's in this Fifth Ward community that we get so many great people out of one particular area?
Well,
including yourself.
Well, in this the culture of segregation, of the institution of segregation, for some reason in Houston, we had communities that were at least four of the black communities, and they were called wards.
Mm-hmm.
In the Fifth Ward, I grew up. In the fifth ward, I very seldom went into the third ward because then I was considered the boy from the other high school, and I would have to fight my way out of there. We had football teams who, you know, Wheatley and Yates on Thanksgiving Day. That was a major, major game, and it was played at the high school stadium. It was such a fascinating game that they had they had segregated seating for the white fans to come out and watch the black teams play. What we had and in that particular day, and this is the one thing that has bothered me with the whole concept of assimilation, segregation, integration, that we loved our teachers. Our teachers were the heroes of the neighborhood.
Wow.
When I got out to California, I was shocked. At 19, in a black community in South Central, I saw the attitude of the local youth there. I saw the lack of a community togetherness like we had here, and And right away, I knew why, because in California, everyone had come from elsewhere. So there was no central feeling, you know, of community. I don't think it was the same love for their high school football teams that we had here in the black neighborhoods in Texas. The high school football teams were tremendously loved. Even the white community loved the black football teams. That feeling of that was a leadership of people who were concerned. When I got into conversation in Los Angeles with some of the musicians who were my age, and I told them about my experiences in the Boy Scouts, they looked at me like I was crazy. The Boy Scouts, they said, "Oh, that's the corniest, dumbest thing you can do." The California boys, or wherever their families had come from, did not have that same sense of community or that sense of leadership coming from the leaders of the community. So it was just quite different, and I was amazed to know that you did not know the neighbors in Los Angeles. I really didn't know my neighbors, and so we didn't have the community spirit, as the old saying going. And when I was a youngster, if I did something bad on the way home from school, the whole neighborhood would call my mother and tell her.
Wow. So building from that community, is it part of, because it's the Louisiana roots and history, since a lot of the residents from the Fifth Ward area in Houston migrated from Louisiana, because you're the far parents, grandparents, and so forth have come out of small towns and small together communities, and when they had to flee, as you mentioned, to Houston, and they all end up in this one particular area, they brought those attitudes and those spirits of closeness and family and looking out for your neighbor to this Fifth Ward community.
Yes, well, we did have that Louisiana culture here, and at the same time, it was in the last 5 or 6 years, I learned something that I really didn't know when I was living here. Texas had a large population of slaves. The cotton industry in East Texas was the largest cotton industry in the United States. We always think of Mississippi, Alabama as having the largest cotton industry, and that's not true. Texas had it. And as the Civil War began, or the fighting started, the slave masters, to protect their slaves, would then send their slaves out to Texas, where they felt that those slaves would then be out of the reach of the Union troops. In other words, the Union troops would not free those slaves that they had sent into Texas. So Texas or Houston and Galveston was the connection of the cotton getting out to the rest of the world. So it was huge. And I'm saying that to say we had a very large Protestant neighborhood here. I was baptized in a Creole Catholic church, but in my block there were three permanent structures of black Baptist churches, and a vacant lot across the street from my parents' home was used as the site of a Holy Rolly tent every summer. They had a World War II Army tent. The sanctified Holy Rolly people would put it up, and they held their services in there. Maybe they would have as many as 40, 50 people in this one tent, And I couldn't understand it because it was no air conditioners in it, and the heat of Southeast Texas, even at nighttime, is sweltering. But they
pretty humid.
It is humid. So the feeling of the church was always strong here, very, very, very strong. And then we did have the Wild West people too, the knife fighting guys, everybody had a knife. They called it a Texas Jack. So you had to be careful. You had to know what block was safe to go down. There were black families. One family was the Broussard family, and another family, I believe, was the Mitchell family, and there were a lot of young boys in this family, maybe five, six, seven boys, and they would terrorize the neighborhood. We had those who would terror. They would spread this violence all throughout the neighborhood.
Wow!
They were the bad guys. We called them the guys who were going for bad.
Wow, that's amazing. So from there, you mentioned the Catholic Church that you were baptized out of Our Mother of Mercy, and ironically, they even have an amazing history itself, built from built on an Indian cemetery, and they built the original church out of lumber from the railroad tracks. Most of them who worked for the railroad just brought the excess over, and they built them the church, and it stood for pretty much for almost 50 years, I believe.
Well, the homes in Frenchtown were actually built with lumber from the boxcars.
Cars.
Yeah, they were retiring the boxcars at the train companies, and they would let the people come in there and purchase the wood very, very cheap. So the Creole people would go down to the railroad yards, and they would come back with this boxcar lumber, which was very, very sturdy. It had been treated, and those homes are actually still standing in those neighborhoods.
Wow, that's an amazing story. In your childhood, how did you get into music?
Well, I was born in 1939, and it was very easy to get into music because that was the only thing that we had for entertainment. You know, living in segregation, I do remember the Negro League, the old baseball league, and I saw some of the black teams in some games when I was a kid. But you listen to the radio. Radio was a big thing, and in the morning that was a radio show, and it seemed like it was on the air entire 19 years that I was here, and it was called, what was it, something about Serenade, Morning Serenade, and you listened to the music. It was big band music. Then it was the gospel stations. It was the blues stations then. R&B hadn't come forth. That didn't happen until 1948, when Louis Jordan created the Timpani Five or a Timpani Seven, where after the big band era had shut down, it was Louis Jordan who came up with the concept of creating what they call a jump band. 1948, you know, Caledonia, what makes your big hit so hard? So then out of the jump band, getting into the 1950s, there was the rhythm and blues, the first music of Louis Jordan eventually became known as rhythm and blues. There was a piano in everybody's living room. Every family, good solid families, had to have a piano in the living room, and someone in the family had to learn how to play the piano. That's how we entertain ourselves. I had an older brother who played piano in an all-black naval band in World War II, and sometimes they would come through Houston and Southeast Texas, and they would play dances at the officers' club at these military bases, and when mm-hmm. they would come through Houston, my mother would then put on a feast for them. This could have been 1944, 1945. I remember all of these black men in my mother's living room, and they were playing instruments. They had on sailor suits, trombone, cornets, clarinets. All of this was going on, and it was very, very interesting, and it was all a mystery. I would just be staring into the bells of the horns, and it was really fascinating to me. So eventually, at 5 years old, I was introduced to Father Kyle. This must have been 1944, at our Mother of Mercy Catholic Church, and Father Kyle asked me, what do you want to do in life? I told him I wanted a trumpet and a sailor suit.
So wow.
I was hooked at 5 years old.
Wow. So who influenced you during that particular time? I mean, you had a lot of great musicians coming out. You had the big band era, as you mentioned, during that time. What did you listen to?
Well, I can tell that my influences of playing blues on the piano, mm-hmm. I believe, came from two people. I mean, of course, I heard the Boogie Woogie guys. I would mm-hmm. hear the Boogie Woogie guys, piano players in what they call a short. It was a film.
Mm-hmm.
That they would run at the black movie houses. Maybe this was 35, 40 minutes long, and you would see comedy, and you would see footage of all the musicians, and that was these two pianists. I think it was Pete Johnson and another guy. I can't remember his name now. It was two of them, and they had two pianos going, and they would play Boogie Woogie, very unique style. But also here in Houston, there was a local guy who had a very unique piano style of blues, and his name was Amos Milburn. Amos mm-hmm. Milburn was on local radio constantly. He was also a singer. His friend in Los Angeles was with a similar style was Charles Brown. Now you must have heard this song. It's always played around Christmas time. What is it? Merry Christmas, Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an old blues song. Well, that was the first style of blues and piano playing that I grew up with. And then the accordion with Clifton Chenier. He was the first live musician, live band I ever saw playing. Again, at my Catholic church, Chenier would play at least twice a month. He would play for a dance. And the kids would just stand there and watch him. He had the accordion, and he would play. Now, since I moved back here in 99, basically, I went out. I found reissues of his recordings and Amos Milburn, and I could tell that they were my very, very first, influences. Now, over in Louisiana, they had Professor Longhair. I heard some of Professor Longhair's piano, his piano style here, but mostly I was weaned on Amos Milburn. Of course, mm-hmm. as I grew older, I began working at 12, 13, 14 years old. I then had money to go out and purchase recordings. And the other thing was that I learned a lot from was short wave radio. If you had short wave radio, I could pick up a broadcast from a Chicago club, a Detroit
wow.
club, and I would then hear a lot of the legends of jazz. It wasn't easy finding jazz here. It was gospel and blues, but there were those native people here or local people here who were absolute jazz fanatics. One man, his name was Mr. Lang, Tiny Lang. He operated the best Texas style his barbecue house was on Lyon, the main street of the Fifth Ward. This guy had a collection of long playing records, singles, and that of all the jazz artists. And I would go over to his home, and he would play me all of this music. I had a two track tape recorder, and I would record the things off of his mono system. So mm-hmm. I learned a lot from a lot of people, a lot of the local lovers of jazz who lived around here, and there were many. We had a strong, let's say underground colony of jazz lovers here.
Okay, we're going to take a break real quick, and we'll be back in a moment again with jazz legend Joe Sample. Be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
Well, welcome back to the program again, Tim Jacquet, The Core Business Show, speaking with Joe Sample, jazz legend. Joe, tell us about your particular style. Your style is unique. It is who you are, and we just spent some time in talking about how you develop, but describe your style.
Well,
the uniqueness of it.
I can remember when I could have been 17, 18, 19 years old, I used to wonder, how do you create a style? And another year would go by, I would ask myself the same question. How do you create a style? But in the meantime, what I was actually doing was preparing my fingers. I had my fingers, my arms, my hands, my body. How do I touch the piano in a way that I like the way I am touching the piano? I used to be able to listen to other recordings, and I would say, I do not like the way that this pianist is touching the instrument. In other words, he's not even touching it; he is sticking the instrument. He is jabbing the instrument. I did not like that tonal quality, but I knew I needed a lot of precision muscles in my hands and my arms to get that sound out of the piano that would turn me off, that would turn me on. And one of my favorite pianists is Vladimir Horowitz. He was the Russian pianist. I described his touch on the piano as melting butter. I love that sound. And that was the sound that I wanted to have, that melting butter sound. Even though he wasn't a jazz pianist, he just got an awesome creative sound out of, a beautiful sound out of the acoustic piano. I used to wonder, why do I play the way I play? And I could never figure that out, and usually I didn't want to play the way I played. I wanted to play in a way that Oscar Peterson played. I wanted to play a combination of Oscar Peterson and this guy of Herbie Hancock, George Shearing. I never imitated anyone. I never copied anyone. But there were those pianists who I welcomed their influence. One day, about the age of 28, I would say 22, 29, I discovered that what I did not like about me, how I played the piano, was the thing that was making me unique. It was the thing that everybody else loved. What I did not like about me was my style.
We are our own worst critic.
I didn't want to play like that. I kept trying to play it different. I guess when you sit there hour after hour and you find yourself, you will become bored with yourself. So you are trying not to do that. But then it eventually occurred to me that this is why people like me, because I am doing that.
Wow. So when you sit at a piano, any piano, I know piano have their own languages. It depends how they regulate it, what brand they have. And if there was a brand, a piano, without, I guess we're musicians, so if there are certain brands that speaks to me personally when I sit down and play a piano. And if it's a Yamaha, I know what it's going to sound like. Quality, I know what it's going to sound like. If I go to get what I want out of it, if it's a Steinway, I know what to get out of it. Out of those particular brands, or I don't know if you have a particular brand preference, is there any brand preference that you can get this sound out of that you love to make music out of? Or, you know, like, for example, I know that if I put a Steinway, I'm going to get a certain sound out of this instrument and this size. If I go to a Yamaha, I'm going to get this bright instrument sound. If I go to a German style, I'm going to get a lot of resonance and drive out of it. When you sit at a piano, what do you get when you actually sit out, you know, for a particular brand? If that's making sense.
Let's say I bought, in 1974, I bought two Yamaha studio pianos, and these are an upright. I still have those two pianos, but, or my son has one. I have one here in my living room. I did most of my composing and writing on those two pianos. I owned a Yamaha 7-foot piano in Los Angeles area, of Beverly Hills after I was married, and I also had a home at Mammoth Lakes, California, a ski resort town in the Sierras, in the eastern Sierras, and that's 300 miles away from Los Angeles. I put one of those uprights there. And I had one of those uprights at the Crusaders' office. I did a lot of writing at Mammoth Mountain. Eventually, that piano now came to Houston. Recording wise, I would always go to the Steinway store and rent a concert grand. Concert grand Steinway, and sometimes I used to go to downtown Los Angeles, and they would rent pianos to all of the classical pianists who were coming into Los Angeles to perform. I then discovered that each pianist preferred one or another of the various ones. Maybe the Steinway Company had available 12 of these concert grands. The pianists then would make a selection. If they were going to play Bach, they preferred let's say piano number 6, or if they were going to play Beethoven, they preferred piano number 3. So it was amazing to learn that that you do get different things out of different pianos. Consistently, or the most consistent piano I have found for my taste has been the Hamburg Steinway. The New York Steinway at one time was a fabulous, great piano, but then CBS in that infamous buyout where they bought the Fender Company, they also bought the New York Steinway, and from that point on, the New York Steinway took a downward turn. The New York Steinway is now today it has returned into that status of being a great piano. But I prefer the feel of Hamburg Steinway. Now, there have been Yamaha pianos that I have liked and loved. And as recently as, I don't know, 4 years ago in Tokyo, I was asked to come to the Steinway store in the Ginza. I went there and they had, I don't know, 20 different pianos in there, and they asked me to play all of them some, and they wanted to then ask me afterwards what did I play, what was my favorite piano, and after I had played them all, I indicated that particular piano was the one that I liked, and they then said to me, we suspected that, and he said that piano has a very, very warm sound to it. And and that's when I said, yeah, all of the other ones are bright, bright, bright. And I asked him, why do you make your piano so bright? And he said, because we make them for the Asian female. They don't have big, powerful hands like Western guys have. So they have to touch the piano lightly. And that brightness helps them in doing that. So in the recording studios, I used to run into very, very bright pianos. So and they do that because there was a lot of rock and roll that was being recorded, and
they need to hear the overtones.
Right, it needed to be able to ring out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when Horowitz was contracted to return to Moscow, which he left, I believe, at the beginning of the Nazi movement, and he moved to New York. He had a flat in New York City. He agreed to go back to Moscow and do a concert at the conservatory there. It was recorded and it was filmed. The place was sold out. I think he made a deal for $6 million to go there and play and record. Now the interesting thing was, a crane was put on top of his New York apartment building, and they got his piano out and they lowered it to a flatbed truck. They took it out to Kennedy Airport and they flew his concert grand piano. I don't know what kind it was, but flew it over to Russia. He wanted his instrument. Now, that's one thing that I think the worst life a musician can have is the life of the piano player. Because usually I'm very dissatisfied with most pianos. I am very, very fortunate here in Houston now. I have the best piano in the world here in my piano room, which is on the other side of the house. And I say that because the Steinway technicians who go all around the world looking for pianos, they will purchase them, buy them, and then they will bring them back to Houston to this refurbished shop, which is about 5 minutes from where I am now living. So I have expertise aid in keeping my piano the exact way that I like it to play. This piano I have now is really responding to my touch.
Wow. So how the music comes to you? Does it come in the middle of the night? Does it come as a thought? How do you actually, how your music come to you?
Let's say this. I prefer music I call them, you know, emotions, musical emotions.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel this melody is coming, and I am wondering, why is it that I know this melody? Where have I heard this melody previously? And I learn, turn on your tape recorder if I'm sitting there playing, or I may be sitting there playing and singing something, humming something, and I always try to figure out what is this piece I'm playing. I know this. So most melodies that I do write, my first introduction to that melody is where do I know this from? Is this, whose song is this? Is this, man, is this something Duke Ellington wrote? Is this something one of the classical guys wrote? And then I record it, and then I go back and look at it, and then I realize that, no, that's my song. I think of them as gifts. Why am I hearing it? You don't think about what note follows the next note. It isn't. It really has nothing to do with thought. It's just me sitting there saying, "Man, I love this melody I am now playing. Oh man, this melody fills me what is this? Where did I get this from? I know, man, this has to be, this must be a Duke Ellington. This must be a whatever, you know. And then later on, I realized that it was something that was just simply passing through me. I call them gifts.
Wow. So when we talk about your gifts, talk about we talked before we went on the air about the elements of style that goes into your playing. You mentioned that it's a mixture of everything. Kind of talk about what that mixture consists of.
Well, here in Southeast Texas, where I grew up, we and the Louisiana roots, that thing I didn't understand was, and I really began to notice this when I became a studio musician in Los Angeles. A lot of times I would be sitting at the piano playing, and one of the musicians would really, really like what I was doing. We were on a break, and I would sit there, and I would start playing, and another musician would join me. The moment that other musician would join me, instead of him playing what I was playing, now I find myself playing what he started playing. In other words,
wow.
The guys could not feel what I was playing. And later I realized, and it was Mary Clayton who told me what that was. She said it's second line. You're from Louisiana. New Orleans. My grandmother came from New Orleans. It's that second line feeling. It's that Mardi Gras feeling. It's New Orleans jazz. It's swing. It's America's rhythm. America's mm-hmm. rhythm is swing. And I try to explain to younger musicians, especially drummers, that you need to learn how to swing, and all you need to swing is one stick and a cymbal. You don't need a big old drum set to learn how to swing. What pushes the American groove, coming all the way back from Ellington and Count Basie, it's swing. The swing was played a little bit tighter, a little bit more up on the top side, and then it got back into the 40s. It was kind of laid back a little. So swing can be played in a hyper, or it can be played set back. And what got me when the rappers first started was disco. I had said, man, America's rhythm is gone. The world has gotten into protruding kick drum that to me becomes monotonous. And all of a sudden, here came the hip hoppers, and what I liked about the hip hoppers was they brought America's rhythm back to dance, and that is swing. And if you go get the Roland drum machine, you will see a button on there that says swing.
Go swing.
you can put in eighth notes or whatever you want to, but if you want it to groove, you have to hit the swing button. That's what it is. That's what the hip hop is. Another. This is simply another version of swing.
Wow. Let's talk about, if you don't mind, since we're going to wrap things up soon. Regarding the Crusaders, how did you start that group? Since you're a founding member, and kind of tell us what have you done with them in the course of these 3 or 4 decades?
Well,
with the group,
it really began at high school. Some particular reason, Hubert Laws, Wilton Felder, Wayne Henderson, Styx Hooper, a bass player by the name of Lala, and myself. Now, we were all in school at the same time, mostly in the same grade, and we were either in the Jazz Orchestra, which was a big band setting, and we were also in the marching band, where in the Wheatley High marching band, I played the clarinet. We had tape recorders then, the reel-to-reel tape recorder. It was like a little small suitcase, and we used to take it around, and someone had recorded something. I had recorded numerous things over at the barbecue man's home that was tiny laying, and we would sit around the campus or at each one's home, and we would just listen to this music. We were fascinated with jazz. And eventually we formed a group that was called the Modern Jazz Sextet. We were heavily influenced by John Lewis, Milt Jackson, the Jazz Quartet. So we formed a group called the Modern Jazz Sextet. And eventually we went on to become the winners of a high school talent contest in Houston. And this was the first time that an interracial event happened. So somehow we won this thing, and it was and we were amazed. And Styx Hooper, in the meantime, was he had access to a station wagon, and he formed a band called the Swingsters. Now, the Swingsters were made up mostly of tenor saxophone players. Houston had a large number of saxophone players, especially the tenor saxophone and guitar players. There were few piano players, few bass players. In fact, there were practically no bass players here, and I don't know why. And that was one thing that the Crusaders suffered throughout all of our years, and we had nothing but promises, problems with. One day, I remember somewhere around 78 or 79, I said to Styx, will we always be doomed with this problem of never having a bassist? Wilton Felder learned how to play the electric bass so he could indicate to bass players how our music should be played. Then he would overdub his saxophone. That was a weak link that I knew eventually it was going to hurt the band. At times it became impossible to go out and do a really a good live performance. We would struggle, and it was and guys would say, I don't want to imitate Wilton Felder. I want to do my thing. And I said, well, I think you don't understand. Wilton Felder ain't imitating nobody. Wilton Felder is just playing my song the way the song is asking for somebody to play it.
Yeah.
The song will tell you how it should be played.
Sure.
That wasn't Wilton Felder's style. I mean, you know, I wrote.
You just imitate the style. Yeah, you just, that's what you hired to do.
The song itself dictates to you. When I just wrote a work for the NDR big band of Hamburg, Germany. It will be released, I believe, in September. I will be touring with them October and November for 5 to 6 weeks in and out of Germany. And I let some of my friends hear the recording. And their comment is, man, it sounds like the Crusaders with a Crusaders big band. Why? Because it's my writing. So
wow,
we had that particular problem with the group, and eventually, you know, and at that same time, we were working with blues artists on the weekends. My parents would let me go off with some of the Texas, the legends of blues. So I did that frequently, and I learned a lot of blues from a lot of masters around here. That jazz, that blues, the gospel that was coming in every single day, and the love of classical music, which Houston at that time also had a symphony, an opera, and a ballet company. So there was a lot of music that was going on here. And one of the shocking thing, I asked this guy at the Steinway Piano Store, how in the hell did you decide to put in a repair shop, a refurbished shop of the Steinway Piano in Houston? And he said, because this city does have the opera, the symphony, the ballet, the chorus thing, the Rice University, great, great musical schools here. And he said, and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of very rich people who want a big, beautiful piano in their living room. And they don't even play them. They want the best, the players to come into their homes and play their very expensive pianos. Rich people. That's why Steinway has that music store here.
I agree. I totally agree. How did you come up with a couple of things real quick? How did you come up with the name Crusaders? And was it called the Jazz Crusaders, or just always called the Crusaders?
The Jazz Crusaders.
Okay.
We had an offer. It's called a recording audition. It was with Richard Bach of Pacific Jazz Records, was told about us through a man known as Curtis Amy, another Texas tenor from Houston. He was the husband of Mary. I'm going brain dead now. So he gave us the offer. So the deal was you record side A in 3 hours on a Monday. You come back Wednesday. You record side B in 3 hours. You will get the opportunity to record two takes on each song. So you need enough material. You need 8 to 10 songs to come in and record. I wrote a piece that was called The Freedom Sound. I named it, and eventually that first recording was titled The Freedom Sound. Dick Bach came in after the third recording. He said to us, fellas, relax. You are now recording artists. What do you call yourselves? We didn't have a name. One of the girlfriends said, I know who you guys are. I see what you guys do. You guys have always been crusading for jazz. Why don't you call yourselves the Jazz Crusaders? That's how
wow.
It came about. Eventually she married Styx, so the band was actually named by Styx Super's wife. You still there?